Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast.
The feeling of happiness is like a warm feeling inside you. It's like, it feels good.
It feels like this warm feeling when you drink a hot drink on a cold day, giving this much peace and calmness inside.
Happiness. You know it when you feel it. And according to the latest World Happiness Report, Canadians are generally a fairly happy bunch. Out of more than 140 countries, Canada ranked 15th happiest overall. And so we went and asked people on the streets of Vancouver if they could define what it is that makes them happy or not.
Happiness is having a good, peaceful life. Simple. If you have a peaceful life, you're happy. I mean, there's hardships in life, so I don't think that's the reason for unhappiness. These are hardships, you have to live with that.
I think when you have too much expectation, high expectation, then you, of course, you end up being unhappy, right? Because you don't meet that expectation.
Right now, I'm pretty happy, I guess. Yeah, ecstatic.
Tell me why.
It's a nice day for the most part. Keeping positive about things, I guess. Just don't sweat the small stuff.
I feel like my friends, and personally maybe like school, I do like school, it makes me quite happy, and I like to hang out with my friends there. I actually like to do quite a lot of like schoolwork. That does make me a little happy. Not the homework part, the schoolwork part.
I believe that happiness really starts from the inside of the person, not so much on what the outside is. I believe by helping kids for my job currently, for example, does bring me a lot of joy that's words even can't describe myself. It's not so much about the money I do this for, but importantly, changing lives one day at a time, one life at a time, as a matter of fact.
While Canada still ranks fairly high on happiness, it's not all sunny. John Helliwell is one of the report's lead authors, a professor emeritus at the University of British Columbia's Vancouver School of Economics, and he is a founding editor of this happiness report. John, hello.
Hello.
15th, that's not so bad. How happy are Canadians overall, do you think?
Well, the 15th sounds about right. I was impressed by your on-the-street people. They certainly put their fingers on all the important things that we tend to find when we try and explain the difference between the happier countries and the less happy countries.
Are we getting happier or are we getting less happy?
Canada's gone down in the last 10 years by about half a point on the 10-point scale. And it's almost entirely due to declining happiness among those under 30, which has dropped almost a full point over those years, and matching the United States in that respect.
I'll ask you about that in a moment. If you take a look at the ranking overall, the happiest countries, Finland's at the top. Who else is above us?
Well, we have basically the five Nordic countries are always above us, and then we've got Israel is in there now, having been out of the top 10 initially. And then we have Luxembourg and Netherlands and Australia and New Zealand. Mm-hmm. I think New Zealand's just out of the top 10 and Australia just in it. They jostle for position.
What about the unhappiest?
Afghanistan rules the roost by an increasing margin, unfortunately. Lebanon also right down there. It's often countries, as you might guess, who's got extreme internal disorder and no one's happy.
So every 3 years, Gallup surveys 150,000 adults in 140 countries, and these samples are then weighted for a few different things, landline and cell phone coverage, the demographics of each country, and then you kind of use that data to pull all of this together. As you understand it, how are people asked to assess their level of happiness?
There are a lot of emotional questions asked, but the central measure we use, a question initially proposed by Aristotle, was ask people to think, in this case, it's called the Cantrell ladder. Think of your life as a ladder with the best possible life as a 10 and the worst possible life as a 0. How would you rank your life these days?
Mm. And aside from the philosophy, I mean, you roll in some other data as well, right?
No, that's it. What we do, we then try and explain the differences by using other data.
Oh, okay.
But we're not doing any making up of anything. We're just reporting back what people in the countries actually are saying and have been saying over the preceding 3 years.
You're not including things like GDP and life expectancy within that? I mean, that just is kind of looked at in relation to what people say?
they're only involved in our explanations of international differences.
Right.
When we get down to interpersonal differences, the kind of things that your people on the street are mentioning come out loud and clear.
What do you think we could learn from Finland?
Well, they care for each other. It's quite striking. And that leads them to have institutions that give everyone an equal. They like their institutions. Their teachers are high status people. Everybody has equal chance at education and healthcare. So they all start off on the same footing. They're much less materialistic than other cultures, so they don't care so much. They want to have their place on the lake, but it's a shack, and it's the beauty of the lake they like more than the size of the shack.
They may not be materialistic, but it's worth mentioning that, I mean, most of the countries that are in the top 20 are wealthier nations. They're white nations, largely, or dominant white nations. They have higher GDPs. And I know that you don't measure GDP, but you use that as a way to explain some of the answers. How closely do you think income is correlated with happiness?
Not terribly. It's
really
an important part of the story. We find the six factors we use explaining things, the four ones that are more social factors, together more important than income, is explaining the differences across countries. That's what's one of the big surprises to people, is that income's important, but not very important. So other things can dominate it quite easily.
We're going to talk more about that in a moment. But that's why I said really to you, because I think there are a lot of people who would assume, based on the rankings, that if you have more money in your pocket, that if you aren't struggling to make ends meet, struggling to find food, that you're generally going to be in a happier place.
Well, up to some level, that's true. In other words, having enough. We've asked people, have you had enough to eat in the last 2 weeks? Those who haven't are unhappy. But once people have the necessary, then they'll give answers like your people on the street. None of them said, I want to be richer, or make me happier to be rich.
You'll know that there has been criticism of this report in past, that the idea of happiness here is being measured by people in the West. That there are different cultures that have different ideas of what happiness is, and that academics in Western countries and a U.S. company in Gallup might have an idea of what happiness is, but that may not square with other people's views of happiness. How fair do you think that criticism is?
This is a criticism lodged about conventional psychology, where most of the experiments are done with people from Western nations. This goes out and simply asks people to rate their own lives. So there's no Western orientation to that. And it's all over the world being asked the same thing. So we can then test a lot of things to see whether they are special to the West or not. One thing in this year's report, we had a big survey of India in our first chapter, specializing on India. And we find in India that within the older group, they get happier year by year. Other people had thought that was the kind of thing that only happened in Western countries with their more elaborate social safety nets, but it turns out to be equally true in India.
What about the other end of the age spectrum? You mentioned younger people, people under 30. We'll let other folks figure out whether under 30 is young still or not, but how happy are younger people in this country?
Not happy. I mean, this is one of the big findings we find. If we rank the happiness by the happiness of those over 60, Canada ranks 8th and the U.S. ranks 10th. If we look at the happiness of those under 30, Canada ranks 58th and the U.S. 62nd. So that's right down in the middle of the world rankings.
Why do you think that is?
Well, we don't know. It's big. It's new. It's happened within the last 10 years. It wasn't that way 10 years ago. And there are not very many fundamental things about life that have changed in that period. And we find it's mainly true in English-speaking countries, Canada, the United States, New Zealand, Australia. And we look deeper into the Canadian data, and we find the drop is only half as big in Quebec as in the rest of the country. So it is something going on with what, in the English language media, both social media and others, people are hearing about the world and getting a little depressed about it. You could imagine the number of conflicts that might lead you to think that.
What about what we were just talking about, which is the economy? The fact that people under 30 live in an environment now where they think they'll never be able to own a home. They don't know whether they're going to have stable employment. They're working gig work because they can't make ends meet. That might lead them to be unhappy.
It might. We're looking at something that happened over the past 10 years. And the individual respondents in Canada and the United States have roughly the same employment levels and income levels as they did 10 years ago. There may be more uncertainty about that. And quite clearly, the housing issue is an important one, which has achieved more importance in the last 10 years.
This idea of happiness is kind of a slippery subject. And I wonder, how do you define happiness compared to things like joy or wonder, which are also things that people, it's hard to define, but people know them when they feel them.
Absolutely. And of course, as you might imagine, there are surveys all over, including the one we use, that have lots of measures of different emotions. And then you can say, how much do these different emotions play in to your sense of overall happiness? We find that the positive ones play into the overall life evaluation much more than the negative ones do. So the emphasis on the positive is clearly a good recipe to follow.
Should happiness really be the goal? I spoke with the author of a book the other day about languishing. And his point was that we live, and this is a bit of you know, how different cultures define happiness, but we live in a society, largely in the West, where people talk about purpose and people talk about your goal in life. And if you aren't doing that, if you aren't hitting the ball out of the park every single time you're at the plate, you can feel like you're not achieving your purpose, and that can lead you to feel unhappy and lead you to that place of languishing. So should happiness be the goal, do you think?
I think it's a mistake to think of it as, especially at the personal level, to think of your own happiness as the goal. Happiness is the consequence of a life well lived. So if you focus on important things like helping others and making a better world, you will end up happier, but don't chase it or it'll disappear.
If I'm a policymaker in this country who's listening right now, what should I take from this report? What should I think about that might make a substantial difference in somebody's life that would lead them to say that they are happier in this country?
Well, one of the things that is important is they should be a little less fearful about opening doors between different parts of letting people open doors. So putting grade 6 classes into elder care facilities, a whole range of ways of enabling people to make positive, serious, life-giving connections to each other. And that will build happiness. And it takes a certain amount of guts to do that when everyone else is being risk-averse and locking doors in order to keep people safe. But by keeping them safe, it's keeping them lonely.
Mm. And just finally, in this moment where, I mean, and I say this as somebody who talks about the news is often really bad. There's a lot that's really terrible in the world right now. People are struggling. There's a lot of anxiety. And it can be tempting to just be consumed by that and think that that's the only reality that exists right now. In the face of that, why is it important to talk about what makes us happy instead of what makes us unhappy?
Because to avoid and get over that negativity bias is one of the fundamental secrets to happiness. And it's clearly necessary for the under 30s in North America who are indeed consumed by that negative news. And so they have to learn a lesson that apparently people are learned after middle age more easily, to be able to put the bad things in the door and put them away and focus on the positives and, more importantly, what they can do about it.
John, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
John Helliwell is the lead author of this year's World Happiness Report, professor emeritus at the University of British Columbia's Vancouver School of Economics. While many of those countries that are at the top of the happiness list are indeed relatively wealthy, there is new research from McGill University that shows that the connection between wealth and happiness is not necessarily cut and dried. Chris Barrington Lee was one of the authors of that study, associate professor at McGill's Department of Equity, Ethics, and Policy at the Beeler School of the Environment. Chris, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Canada, 15th on the world happiness list. Does that seem about right to you?
Sure. I mean, it's Canada. Using an overall average for all across ages, Canada has not moved rapidly year to year. So that's no big surprise, but as you just heard, it's been on a slow, steady downward trend.
Mm. Why did you want to look in the context of this at the relationship between happiness and wealth or income?
Well, maybe two reasons. I mean, the one is the old, maybe instinctive reason that you refer to, but also as an economist, it's the question that people went to first in this field a few decades ago. And it continues to have a lot of focus, maybe for obvious reasons. But the second reason is that wealth stands in this study a little bit as just meaning as a way to differentiate quite different cultures. In other words, the communities that we looked at are really on a different wealth scale. So it, in some sense, wealth is clearly not even a relevant measure. And by that, I mean that these are what we call minimally monetized societies. So most people are not actually largely earning wages and supporting themselves that way. They are they're mostly subsistence, meaning you can imagine they fish, they hunt, they gather. On the other hand, these are not like uncontacted communities, so they typically do have income in monetary terms, but it's only maybe $1,000 or $1,500 a month, and actually it ranges down to $10 not a month. I'm sorry, per year. It ranges down to $10 per year. So these are people who are not disconnected from broader industrialized and global society. They know what life is like a little bit out there. They have consumer products, but not much. And so the idea was, I mean, this is the data from a broader study, but this is an opportunity to go and look at how life satisfaction reports, these overall life evaluations of people look in places where they, you know, they've education enough to use this numeric scale happily. They have some labor income, as I said, but not much. But really, their lives are, you know, maybe they're playing a different game than most of the people who we have been studying and who answer these nationally representative surveys like the Gallup World Poll.
How did you measure how happy they were?
Well, in nearly exactly the same way as John Helliwell described. So this is using an overall life evaluation question. In our case, we were using the one that's worded slightly differently, but it just asks, taking all things into account, how satisfied are you with your life these days on a scale of 0 to 10?
And what did you learn?
Well, the simple result is that we find a range of answers that look like those of a range of countries that have 10 times as much income. You know, in other words, these societies were generally quite happy, and a number of them were as happy as the richest countries.
What does that tell you? You said in some ways they're playing a different game when it comes to happiness. So what does that tell you? Because that seems counterintuitive and led to that question that I asked John about the relationship between wealth and income and happiness.
Well, a detail is that if we look within each of these communities or even across them, it's still the case that there is that correlation between the wealth as we were able to measure it, which you can imagine is, you know, not even a great measure, and their life evaluation reports. So just like, you know, you asked John about whether that relationship was strong. And of course, a problem is if you ask only about the relationship between two variables, then you find that they are related. And as John told you, when you include in your analysis more life factors, and in particular, all the ways in which we are socially connected to others, then the explanatory power of income starts becoming less. So in this case, if we just didn't know about the rest of the world, we would say, people who seem to have more monetary income tend on average to be happier in these societies. But this would be missing the enormous big picture here, which is that these people are just as happy as in places where we have vastly higher levels of material affluence, at least measured through money, right? So these are also places where, in some sense, you know, if you measured wealth differently, you might say these are very wealthy places. They can walk out their door and they have a social security net, or they have a, you know, an income security net of the abundance of being able to fish and hunt. So in that sense, it's just breaking down some of our own natural instincts to think about what is it in my environment, in my culture, in my life that is going to make life easier or make me happier, and to realize that that's not baked into to our DNA, to our evolution. The biggest lesson from our whole field is that we're incredibly social beings, and so the right way to think about predicting how good people feel about their lives is really always socially mediated. And so this is an example to go and look at people who maybe have a very different relationship to the modern industrial life that we live. Mm. And not surprisingly, we will there also find that the happier people are those who have positive connections to others and trusting relationships and are able to feel safe, feel loved, and feel fulfilled by being able to help others and being useful to others.
What do you think, just before I let you go, because we are out of time, but what should we take from that in a society, as you said, a modern industrial society, where, you know, happiness is often related to wealth, wealth generation. We talk about productivity, consumption. These things are going to make you happy. But what could we take from what you've learned?
Well, one extremely important thing from my perspective is that we need to keep an open mind about how good life might be in slightly alternative world, slightly alternative futures of our own. And, you know, one important one of those is what would happen if we imposed some material constraints on society in accordance with our environmental exigencies, our environmental imperatives. I've grown up in a world in which there's been this tension, this dichotomy between economy and environment. It's very difficult to get out of in discourse and in mindset. And I think we need to break free of that and think about what does a good future look like, and then work backwards and see how we can get there. And the idea of living with less, material impact on the world really might not be a direct threat to our well-being.
Chris, I'm going to leave it there. There's a lot to think about in that last answer. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Chris Barrington Lee is an associate professor at McGill University's Department of Equity, Ethics, and Policy at the Beeler School of the Environment. What makes you happy, and how do you define what happiness actually is? As I say, it's kind of a slippery concept, but you know it when you feel it.